welcome to episode 89 of our podcast, Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague, Perry Middlemiss. How are you doing, Perry?
Not too bad, thanks, David. A little bit cold over the weekend, over Easter.
Yes, a bit chilly, yes.
Not what I was expecting, but a forecast of winter coming, I think. But otherwise, everything's fine. Ticking along okay, which is good.
That's jolly good.
And yourself?
Oh, yeah, we've been having social things happening, I think I might have mentioned, but we've had a couple of get-togethers with friends, including some people we haven't seen in quite a while, so that's been good. It's been very good.
Always a good thing to do. I received my fifth dose of the vaccine, COVID vaccine, yesterday, so far I have yet to grow any green tendrils, nor pick up any superpowers, so okay. I'm a little bit disappointed yet again.
I had mine about a week ago, I suppose, so yeah, I haven't had any reaction to that either, so that's good.
The only reaction I get, and I know it's different for everybody else, but the only reaction I ever get is I get a little bit of a sore arm, which is, as I've pointed out before, you know, perfectly understandable, seeing that somebody stabbed me with a small bit of metal into the muscle. You know, it sort of hurts a bit for a couple of days, and it's a bit sore, but it's nothing, it's just a slight bit of discomfort, there's nothing else. So good to be up to date with that, so I'm quite happy that I have achieved number five.
There you go, Very good.
So, other than that, we do have a bit of news.
News, David, that's good.
In the SF and F fields, the Philip K. Dick Award winner was announced since we last spoke. Now, this is given out by at NorrisCon, I think, in the US. It's given out to the best paperback published in America in the previous year, and this year, the winner is The Extractionist by Kimberly Unger, not a book that I have heard of. I'll just give you a bit of brief information about it. An extractionist is someone who pulls souls who are lost in the virtual world back into offline reality.
So it's
referred to as a breakout technical thriller, and Kimberly Unger is a reality expert. A virtual reality expert, I suppose most of us could say that
we're all reality experts.
But this is a virtual reality expert. So she's created this novel, and it looks Philip K. Dick novel is always worthwhile basically having a bit of a look at. I don't always get to it as much as I should, but they always find things that I've just never heard of, which... always a good thing. Always a good,
good thing to have something pointed out.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Now, the other major award that was handed out over Easter, actually presented at the British EasterCon over this past weekend, were the BSFA, that's the British Science Fiction Association Award winners. I'll only give you the top three. The Best Fiction for Younger Readers, Unraveller by Frances Harding.
I should look that up. Yeah, Lucy's very keen on her.
Lucy Sussex is very keen on Frances Harding. So should check that one out. The Best Short Fiction, which is basically anything less than a novel, won by Of Charms, Ghosts and Grievances by Elliot de Bodard. I quite like her work. I think she's a very interesting writer, and I will... check that out. I'm not sure where that one's from, but they're pretty on one of the online magazines. And the best novel for last year was City of Last Chances by Adrian Tchaikovsky.
Tchaikovsky
is also somebody who is building up quite a reputation. He's he does a lot of good, solid, hard science fiction with... I know he wrote his... Children of Ruin series, which is about the expansion of the human race out into the galaxy, but things being left behind, and because of the fact that everything's going to go slower than the speed of light, Everything took a fair while to catch up with things, and by the time humans got back to some of their colonised planets, they found that some of the native creatures had evolved very, very rapidly.
Mm.
Mm. First one.
Here's a writer I must catch up with. I've really only read his a novella by him. I hadn't even read anything longer than that, so I must...
Okay, well, he's won a couple of BSFA awards, and the first one of his that that I read evolved was in this continuing series, and involved an uplifted or evolved race of spiders.
Okay.
So a bit on the scary side, but a very, very interesting piece of work, and it hung together extremely well. So he writes a good story, and worthwhile keeping an eye on.
Yes, yeah, I must get to his
work. By God, he's prolific. He seems to be putting out one or two books a year, plus a few shorter pieces like novellas and so on. So sometimes you get to the point where some of these authors, you know, it's just hard to keep up.
Yeah. But... Okay, how can they write them faster than you can read them? Yeah, I know.
Try we must, David. Indeed, we must.
Oh, that's interesting. Good.
Right. Well, that's about my news for this week. And anything from you?
We haven't heard any more about the Worldcon in Chengdu.
No, nothing much
nothing
as yet.
Any significance? No. We're still with the nominations are now open, aren't they, for the Hugos?
They are, and I don't know how long.
I believe I have.
I haven't voted as yet. I'm still sort of getting my act together and trying to work out what I could do. The good thing about the voting forms, though, is that it isn't just a once-off where you vote, you can't vote again. You can actually go back in and add to your add or amend your existing voting, so that if you've decided that you've read something that was far better than what you'd put on your list, you can actually go in and take something out and put a new one in. Or if you haven't if you haven't nominated up to five in each category, which is the maximum that you're allowed, you can go and add another one in.
Add one, yeah, that's good.
So there you are. So that's all right. But I still have to get to that, and I'll be doing that in the next couple of weeks, I think. I want to finish off one book that I'm currently reading, and then I shall have see whether that should go onto the list. I'm only about 150 pages through it, but at this point, I would say that it's a fair chance it's going on.
All right.
We shall talk about that one later.
All right, Perry, so what have you been reading recently?
Well, one of the interesting little books that I've been picking up recently is from the 1960s, and might be one that you know a little bit about, David. And it's an alternate history novel, or is it a novel, called Pavain by Keith Roberts.
Oh, yes.
Now, Roberts, I look on this as being a collection of stories rather than a straight novel, because while... I think there are about five or six stories actually in this particular book. While there are a couple of characters that pop up in two or three of the stories, and one vehicle that pops up in a couple of the stories as well, it doesn't actually give you the feeling of being a full novel, but it sets out to describe an alternate world. So let me just explain what happens here. This is an alternate history novel where the timeline change occurs when Elizabeth I is assassinated in 1588. The Spanish Armada, which was floating around at that stage, set sail for England, defeats the English forces. England is overtaken by Spain. Catholicism is reinstated and the Protestants are... basically exterminated. And then the Roman Catholic Church, based out of Rome, then uses the English forces to defeat Protestants in the Netherlands and in Germany. Now, as a result of this, the Industrial Revolution is delayed so that by the time of these particular stories, which have an internal timeline of being set in the 1960s, technology is really rather backward. Electricity is known about, but is basically forbidden and is only being experimented with by a guild of signalers. And messaging across from one side of the country to the other or across long distances is carried out by the use of high semaphore towers scattered across the countryside. Transportation is by normal means, walking, horses, carts, by trains, or if you want to shift large amounts of cargo from one place to another, they use large steam-driven engines which run on roads. These are sort of like small locomotives that are like big tractors that haul large carts of goods from one place to another. So there's a series of these particular stories. One that deals with the signalers that look after the semaphore towers. And that's, I think, probably the best of them and the first of them that was written. Although I would suggest that all of them are pretty good. It's quite an interesting way that putting all of these stories together gradually builds up a view of what the countryside is and what the country's going through in this particular alternate timeline. And you get to the end of the collection, the last story, where a particular noblewoman has decided that she really doesn't like the way that she's been treated by the Archbishop of Canterbury, who's at this point Roman Catholic Archbishop of Canterbury, who tells her that she needs to pay all this money give a certain tithe of all the wheat. And she points out that they've had three bad seasons and she can't do this because her people will starve. And to which the Archbishop has said, his line is, well, tough. You have to pay it and that's it. And she says, well, no, I'm not going to. And starts basically a revolution. This is a very, very interesting set of stories. One of the great alternate history sequences of stories. But this was all he wrote about this, which is a bit of a pity because I think there was probably more that he could have done. But then again, I can also see that isn't it always best to go out, David, when you leave your readers wanting more rather than thinking, that's an odd story about sportsmen. Always go out when everybody says, why did they leave now rather than why didn't he go earlier? You know, don't overstay your welcome. Do what you need to do. Get it done. Do a really good piece of work and then move on. And he's done that with this particular book. So this was all the stories here were published in New Worlds and SF Impulse, the major United Kingdom prozines from the 1960s that were edited by Michael Moorcock. And they were all published in 1966. And this particular collection, and I'm going to call it a collection rather than a novel, came out in 1968. And it is certainly worthwhile looking out for. It's a wonderful piece of work.
I read it probably when it first came out or not long after it first came out, but so I can't remember very much of it. So however many decades that is back, but I do remember enjoying it. So I'm not sure, I may have a copy around the house. If I've got a copy around the house, I'll go hand it up and read it again. It'd be well worth doing.
I think it's quite short. It's under 200 pages. There's about six novelettes in it, so you can read each one completely individually. Just read one a day and you finished it in a week. And excellent stuff. I was reading it because I gave a talk at the Nova Mob about short science fiction from 1966. And there were all of these stories came up into that. And there's a couple that probably aren't as... Well, there's always a couple that aren't as good as the others. You know, there's a hierarchy in terms of, you know, which ones are the best stories there. The first and last stories are probably the best in the particular collection. But that isn't to say that the others are poor. They're above poor. They're well above poor and above average into the good or even up into the excellent level. So, but certainly recommended.
Well, I can see that alternate history is going to be a bit of a theme in this episode because I'm going to talk about an alternate history book too. And this is Civilizations by Lauren Binet, translated from the French by Sam Taylor. And this is a very clever piece of alternate history, which completely and yet plausibly, I thought, inverted Jared Diamond's classic Guns, Germs and Steel, which I know is one of your favourite books. But this turns it on its head completely. So instead of the Europeans overcoming the long-established civilizations in the Americas, in this novel, the Inca and then the Aztecs conquer most of Western Europe. Sounds crazy? Maybe. But then how crazy in the real history is it that Francisco Pizarro and his group of only 168 men overcame the long-established and mighty Inca Empire? It's pretty crazy too.
Germs.
But this is how the story is overturned in this history. So in any alternate history, it's always interesting to look for the breaking point, the one incident which shifts the story into a different trouser leg of time, as Terry Pratchett so memorably called it. And here it's what happens to Freydis, who's the daughter of Eric the Red, who, with a large group of Vikings, sail west from Greenland to Vinland, where Leif Erikson established a short-lived colony in North America in about the year 1000. And for various reasons, Freydis, Eric's daughter, is expelled from this newly established settlement there, and with a group of followers and supplies, including horses and cattle, set off to make their own settlement. But storms drive them south along the North American coast, and they keep trying to settle down and develop good relationships with the local inhabitants, but lots of things go wrong, including the fact that the Vikings bring with them serious illnesses, germs from the old world, which devastate the local populations, of course, only sparing a few people. So Freydis and her crew are expelled time and time again, moving further and further south before finally finding a resting place in South America, where they're able to establish a permanent colony and interbreed with the locals, to whom they teach the techniques of ironworking and other arts. And of course, the locals who survive the germs that the Vikings bring with them have become largely immune to those diseases, you know, because the survivors are the ones who have developed immunity. Now, centuries pass, and until a Spanish-funded adventurer called Christopher Columbus arrives in what we now know as Cuba. And we get a long section purporting to be extracts from his journal. But in this new timeline, the natives are no pushover for the Spaniards. The natives have iron-tipped arrows and spears and horses, and it's not long before Columbus and his crew are overpowered and captured. Columbus himself dies years later in captivity, nursed in his decline by the Cuban princess, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, Higuenumata, then only a child. But she, however, is adept at learning Columbus's language, because Columbus doesn't learn the local language. So she learns his language of Castilian in order to talk to him. Now, Columbus leaves behind his journals, his maps, and the wrecks of his ships. And, of course, in Europe, no one ever hears from Columbus or his men again, and that's not going to send any more of those expeditions out. You know, nothing ever happens. We spent a lot of money. Nothing happened. And so we move forward again in time, but this time only a few decades. Now, in what is now Peru, a civil war is raging between... This is all actually historically true. A civil war is raging between the brothers Huescar and Atahualpa. Atahualpa loses the war and is forced north, and eventually he retreats all the way to the island of Cuba. And here he meets the beautiful Higuenumata, now the queen. She tells him about the arrival of strange people from the east decades ago when she was a child. You get the idea. Itahualpa and his band are able to rebuild Columbus's ships and, rather improbably, I admit, learn how to sail them. He takes a few hundred of his people east, and they arrive in Lisbon just after it suffered a major earthquake. And they've got a lot of supplies with them, so they're able to help out the local people. I won't go into a lot of more detail. You really should read the book. But one thing leads to another, and eventually the Inca group take power in Spain, having captured the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V, holding him ransom. Ultimately, after Charles's death in a botched rescue attempt, Atahualpa is declared Emperor, Holy Roman Emperor. And for a while, peace reigns. But then the Aztecs arrive, having followed the trail the Incas have already blazed. Look, it's a wonderful concept, very cleverly done. But I would criticise it in the sense that the book's very uneven. The early parts with Freydis, the Viking person, and particularly the Columbus's journal, are very well-paced and very interesting. And later on, there's some very amusing correspondence between Sir Thomas More and Erasmus about the new religion of the sun, which is being spread by the Inca, which is gleefully seized upon by Henry VIII because it permits men to have as many wives as they like. But there are other parts of the book which read rather like a school history textbook and can be rather tedious, particularly if you're not very familiar with the true history being subverted. And at the end of the book, rather tacked on, is the story of what happens to one Miguel de Cervantes in this new timeline. But very entertaining, clever, very, very clever concept, and very plausibly done. You sort of, you know, really lead you on bit by bit until you accept the what seems like a very implausible concept. Very clever.
Okay, sounds like an interesting piece of work.
Yeah, it is. It's good. Well worth reading.
Let's move on to the topic of today's talk,
Main
David.
Topic, yeah. Well, this is interesting. It's going to be interesting, actually, because we're going to talk both about a television series and the novel on which it's based. And this started off with Perry letting me know that there was a BBC television series of Life After Life, based on the novel by Kate Atkinson, available. So he's watched that and I watched that. And then each of us read the book. But I had read the book previously. I read the book when it first came out in 2014. That's because I'm a big, big fan of that particular writer. And basically everything that she puts out, I usually buy a copy and read pretty well straight away. So that's what I did. But it was very interesting to go back and reread it. Because we're talking about both the TV and the book, I thought what I'd do is simply start with a short summary of the concept, if you like, and the basic plot, and then we can sort of break that down into the TV series and the book. All right. And the TV series, I should say, follows the book pretty closely. It leaves out things. Of course, it has to get everything in, but it's pretty close to the book. So the basic story. The story has a fascinating premise. And that's that the protagonist, Ursula Todd, lives her life over and over again. Each time she dies, she's reborn as a baby at the exact same date and time in 1910. So Ursula dies many times. I think I counted it in the book at least 15, 16, maybe more times during the book. She dies many times during the book for many different reasons. When she's reborn, she doesn't remember her previous life. But she does have vague premonitions and feelings which allow her sometimes to avoid whatever went wrong in her previous life and led to her death. But these feelings of having been here before slowly grow stronger and more definite through the course of the book. And we follow Ursula episodically through her many lives through the first half of the 20th century with a major focus on the Second World War and in particular the London Blitz. We also get a deep insight into the lives of a middle-class family between the two world wars. So that's the basic background concept. Perry, do you want to talk perhaps about what you felt about the TV series? You hadn't read the book before, so this was your first exposure to the concept.
Yeah, well, the first exposure to this particular
iteration of the concept.
Iteration of the concept, and we'll talk about that a little bit.
Interesting similarities.
Yes, I actually watched the TV series before I saw the before I read the book, and I enjoyed the television adaptation quite a lot until the end. And this is my major problem with this particular iteration of this particular subgenre. So how about I basically talk a little about the subgenre and then I'll come back,
sure.
Because if I talk about what my problems are, you won't know what it's like in context. So I had a little bit of a look around to get a few definitions. Now, should point out that this particular novel fits into what could be loosely referred to as a subgenre of science fiction, although, and I will explain why later on, I don't believe this is a science fiction novel at all.
No.
I think this is just a literary novel that uses a science fiction meme to make a point and to try to use it as a frame. So anyway, the subgenre we're talking about here are the time loop subgenre of science fiction. Now, Wikipedia defines a time loop or temporal loop as a plot device in fiction whereby characters re-experience a span of time which is repeated, sometimes more than once, with some hope of breaking out of the cycle of repetition. Important point there, which I'll come to. the term time loop is sometimes used to refer to a causal loop. However, causal loops are unchanging and self-generating, whereas time loops are constantly resetting. When a certain condition is met, such as a death of a character or a clock reaching a certain time, the loop starts again, possibly with one or more characters retaining the memories from the previous loop. Now, they say possibly retaining the memories, because it doesn't necessarily have to happen. But there has to be some point in the looping and going back and restarting again. And in general, you can pretty much say that there is some retention of either direct memories or feelings or emotions from one iteration to another. That's certainly what happens here in Life After Life, where our main character, Ursula Todd, who is the one that is being consistently reborn, she suffers from what some people in the novel might describe as a sort of a overblown sense of déjà vu. And in fact, she does actually get sent to a psychiatrist to actually have a bit of a chat about this. And he doesn't seem to be terribly fussed about this at all. He's very good. He's very, very sanguine about the whole thing. Maybe your brain's just basically working that way, you know. Maybe you have. Who could tell? And if you were, how could I dissuade you from it? I mean, how can I prove that you haven't? And he's really quite good about it. He's one of the sane characters that sits in this, because the first time, especially when I was watching it on the television series, I thought, oh, she's off to this shrink. The guys are really going to get stuck into her. And he's wonderful. He's just really helpful to her. Yeah. And she really appreciates the work that he does with her over the years. Now, okay, so she has these senses that she has been in places before and feels as though things might be best if they are changed. But anyway, let's have a talk about a couple of other stories and books and a film that some people might have heard of, which actually fit also into this subgenre. And the first one I'll talk about just briefly is a story called 1201 by Richard A. Lupoff from 1973. This is a short story in which an executive in New York finds himself reliving the same hour of his life over and over again from 12:01 p.m. to 1 p.m. in the afternoon. And as soon as it hits 1 p.m., bang, he goes back again. But he remembers everything that happened in the previous time, but nobody else does, and he just keeps on rolling through. So that's sort of a very thin time slice of reliving the first one. He was very annoyed, Richard Lupoff, when the film Groundhog Day came out, the one with Bill Murray, where Bill Murray plays this obsequious, he's just
obnoxious.
Obnoxious is the word I'm looking for. A reporter who's a television weather reporter who's out somewhere or other, wherever they have that Groundhog Day in the US, where they bring out the groundhog, and if it sees its shadow, then everything's going to be fine, and if it doesn't, they've got another 6 weeks of winter. And he's stuck in this one day continually. He wakes up the next morning and it's the same song playing on the radio, and he goes through the whole thing again. He's the only one that remembers anything about what happens, and he doesn't know how to get out of this loop. And basically the film really revolves around him trying to work out how to get out of it. Now, the other big one, another book that utilises a very similar theme, is that of Replay by Ken Grimwood. This won a World Fantasy Award back in the 1980s and concerns main character of Jeff Winston, who dies of a heart attack in 1988 and wakes up back in 1963 as an 18-year-old, and then he lives his life again and he dies of a heart attack in 1988 and then he's reborn. But the next time that he's reborn just a little bit later in 1963. And as he goes through his iterations, the gap between the difference in time between when he was born on one iteration and the next starts to increase. It goes to days and then weeks and then months and then years and then decades until he gets all the way right through till he's just reborn just before he dies. And this time he survives his heart attack. And then after that, his replays stop. But in this particular book, he finds other people that are also in the same position, that are also doing exactly the same, where they are reliving lives all the way right through. And he's able to determine this because he comes, while he's living his life, he comes across, or a film is, a major motion picture is released, which he had never heard of before. And so he's able to track down the person that created this major motion picture who has, they've hired Steven Spielberg to direct and George Lucas to write the screenplay. Okay. Both of them just out of college and nobody had ever heard of them before. And the thing just goes absolutely gangbusters and is bigger than, you know, all the big blockbusters you could think of. So that's why he is able to determine that there's somebody else out there that is going through the same process as he is. And they do meet at least one other person in that particular novel. Now, we've also, you and I, David, read The First 15 Lives of Harry August by Claire North, which uses a similar process where, and I must admit, I can't quite remember exactly how the looping works in that. Do you remember?
Yeah, I do. It's not just the lead character, Harry August, we discover eventually, but Harry August dies and he's back again as a baby. But as he reaches sort of being a toddler, he starts to remember his previous life. And his parents think he's gone crazy and they put him in an asylum for kids. And then he commits suicide and then he's back again. And now he starts to realise that what's happening. And he always has, once he's gotten to sort of the age of 4 or 5, he has a perfectly clear memory of what happened before. And he discovers that there are other people around in the world who do the same thing. I think, what does he call them? Urubans, basically on the worm Urubos, yep. Which comes up in Life After Life. So he has a perfect memory of each life, and he uses that fact as a tool to defeat an evil guy who's trying to bring down the universe, kind of thing. So, but he has a very clear perception, whereas in Life After Life, she only has the barest, you know, slight concept of the previous things, but sometimes enough to let her make changes in her current life, which we'll talk about in detail later if you like. But yeah, so there are lots of similarities, but this is a different kind of novel, as you say.
So basically there are different ways of going about dealing with the time loop arrangement, but a lot of it carries on with, as we were just saying, about the idea that the main character retains some sort of memory or feeling from a previous loop, from a previous iteration. And certainly Ursula does that. I thought the fact that it was pointed out to the reader or viewer was much more obvious in the TV adaptation than in the novel. The TV adaptation actually has a voiceover and narration, and sometimes you are going to get some information from that that is gleaned from the novel, but sometimes it is actually, I thought, slightly expanded, and I thought it actually worked a little bit better. There are times in the novel where you sort of think, sure, she knows something here, but it's not really, the author's not really pushing that part of it terribly much. There's one occasion in particular, the one that my wife and I enjoyed quite a lot, was the fact that in one of, well, third or fourth iteration through, Ursula dies of the Spanish flu, which she contracts when she's about 8. And she's able to determine that what happens is that, well, what does happen, although she doesn't remember the exact detail, is that the Irish maid in the household goes with her boyfriend down to London to see the crowds and see the end of the war, comes back with the Spanish flu, passes it on to the whole of the family, and Ursula and her younger brother Teddy end up dying. Now, Ursula gets the feeling that something is going wrong. She's got this feeling of a sense of dread about something going to be happening around about the time that Bridget, in the next cycle, says that she wants to go down to London. And Ursula tries whatever she can to try and stop her from doing so. Yeah, and in the end, gets to the point where, well, I can tell you, I mean, we can tell people this because she pushes her down the stairs and makes it so that she can't actually walk very well and ends up going to not being able to go to London, and therefore doesn't bring the flu back. But she doesn't really know why she's doing it, other than she thinks this is the only way that she can avoid something really bad happening, but she doesn't actually know what
it is. I thought that was all very clever.
So did I. But in the book, I think there's an extra thing where she figures out another way of doing it, which isn't quite as dangerous.
Which is later on, though. Yeah.
Which is much later on in the book. Yeah. And she tries something slightly different later on, because I think she has the feeling of dread about getting into trouble from her parents, because it's not the done thing to go pushing the...
when you're a 10-year-old, the maid down the stairs, trying to kill the maid.
Pushing the maid down the stairs and not being able to say why you did it.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's a bit of a problem. But the major problem that I had with the particular book is that if you take those other stories, Groundhog Day, Replay, there's an ending to it. You get to the point where, in Groundhog Day in particular, this is the one that most people would know, the Bill Murray character actually has to go through a process of learning to be more humane, more thinking of other people rather than thinking about himself all the time, although he has to work this out. As he goes, he just starts getting to that point of view where he starts helping people along the way, pushing people out of the way of cars when they were going to get run down, or catching them after they've fallen out of trees, or helping people across the street, all this sort of stuff. He starts getting to being more of a decent human being. And then at the end, he snaps out of his looping and he wakes up one morning and the song's changed. And he can move on with his life. The difficulty I have with Life After Life is I don't think that is actually going to happen. And that's one of the reasons why I think that I can't see this as a science fiction novel, even though it uses a major science fictional plot device, namely the time looping, as its framework. So it's not a science fiction novel because it only uses part of the whole framework and meme. It doesn't actually go through to the end and actually work out a way to resolve the whole problem.
Okay, now I'm going to tell you why you're completely wrong.
Good.
Because, particularly in the book, it's not so clear in the TV series, I agree. But it's absolutely clear in the book. And that's that the death of Hitler is the key. It's the key to all of Ursula's many lives. Because the book starts with a prologue set in the it's actually set in 1930 in Munich. And Ursula comes into a cafe and she sits down with a group of people who are having coffee and cake in the book. And now Ursula, although she's English, is obviously a well-known acquaintance of these people. It's not evident at first who they are until she quietly pulls out a gun and shoots Adolf Hitler, before being gunned down herself. So, and in a way, not even in a way, that all the rest of the book is dedicated to leading us up to what occurs in the prologue, and that's the ending point. It's the ending point in one way, not in another. If you look at it, she's basically going through all these lives, and she's slowly learning about what she is. She's discovering who she is and what she's there for, in a way. And we get right to the very end, almost right to the very end of the book, and there's a section called The End of the Beginning, which is a Winston Churchill phrase. And in that section, she's actually gone crazy and she's been put into a sanatorium. But she finally understands what she is and what's happening, and she takes control of it. She says to, and there's some interesting things she says. She says to Dr. Kellett, who's come to visit her, this is the psychiatrist. She says to him, this is while she's in the sanatorium, "Time isn't circular," she says to Dr. Kellett, "it's like a palimpsest," which is one of those manuscripts which are written and scrubbed back and overwritten again, so you can see what's partially been written before, and only slightly you can sort of see it because it's there. "It's like a palimpsest." And he says, "oh dear, that sounds very vexing." And she says, "the memories are sometimes in the future." And he says, "you're an old soul," he says, "can't be easy, but your life is still ahead of you. It must be lived." But at that point, what happens in it's actually more clear in the TV series. So at that point, she really understands what she is and what power she's got. She really, by this stage, is really remembering pretty well all her previous lives. And she knows what she can do with it. What she can do with it is to go to Germany, make friends with Eva Braun, which happens in the book, make friends with Eva Braun, who's Hitler's mistress, and through that become an acquaintance of the group around Hitler, to the point where she can be accepted, to the point where she can go and kill him with a gun. So that's the ending point. But what you've got to realise is that as soon as she's killed Hitler, of course, all of Hitler's bodyguards shoot the hell out of her, because she, you know, and so she dies instantly. So she herself can't experience the timeline after Hitler dies because she's killed at that moment. And so she goes back again, but it's things have changed it's a bit differently. But that's the breaking out point. It's the point where she's really realised she remembers everything from her previous lives and knows what she can do with that information. And that's the breaking out point. And the fact that the book continues for a little after that is interesting in different ways, which you can talk about. But that to me is the whole key to the book. So that is the breaking out point.
But it doesn't end there, does it?
It doesn't end there, but that's
because she comes back again. She goes back and does it
but
again.
But not very much. She's only very little after that. But what does happen after that is she meets up with Teddy again. Teddy has survived. At this point, her beloved brother Teddy, she thinks, has died. But now in this new time loop, or maybe she's broken now out of the looping cycle, now Teddy actually survives the war.
Well, do you think that her aim is that she has to kill Hitler to ensure that Teddy survives?
That's what she's doing it for. Well, she's doing it for another reason too, because it's very. I love this book, so I've gone into quite a bit of detail to look at it, because what she says, she sits down in the cafe, and this part is actually only in the body of the book, not the prologue. But she just sits down with the table. She's obviously a friend of the group. You know, she's not a stranger. She's not seen as a threat. She sits down and she quietly says under her breath, you'll excuse my German pronunciation, "Wacht auf, es naht gen dem Tag," which means, "wake up, the day is coming." And Hitler hears that and he's startled and looks up. And then she pulls out the gun and she says to him, "Führer, für Sie," which means, Führer, or leader, "für sie," which means for her. Now, who's the her? To me, it's her daughter, Frieda, who she has in Germany, who dies during the Allied bombing.
Oh, okay, yep.
So, you know, that's the key to me as to why she's done it. But it's also this love of Teddy, too, who she wants to survive. I don't know. I've gone off on a weird sort of tangent, but that is the key to me. I think the assassination of Hitler. Now, the assassination of Hitler using a time machine is also a well-known trope of SF.
This
is so much more subtle, and the whole book leads up to this point. You know, I love it.
Well, actually, the idea of going back with the time machine and going back and killing Hitler is becoming pretty boring these days.
Yeah,
because it's been done so often, everywhere from Doctor Who on down.
But not like this.
No, not like this. No, I'll give you this. My point, though, is that I didn't get the feeling that anything had changed after she'd killed Hitler.
I do, but it is interesting at the end of the book, the fact that there is a life after that. So, yeah, I suppose the other thing which I found really interesting about it is this whole idea, as she says, it's not this perfect repetition every time. This concept of being like a palimpsest, this manuscript which has been scrubbed out and written over again and over again. The whole concept of time in the book is really quite complex, because each iteration of her life isn't exactly the same.
No.
And it's not exactly the same just because of her actions. There are other differences, like Dr. Kellett, in one of her cycles, Dr. Kellett has a son who was killed in the war. In another cycle, he doesn't have a son. In one cycle, her aunt Izzy, for Isabella, I suppose, Izzy has a child, but the child is left in Germany and adopted in Germany. In another iteration, he's adopted by the family. So, there's this fluidity of time in the whole thing, which I really like. And it's not just the repetitions that she's doing and making changes, but there are all these other subtle shifts. You know, it's a very fluid.
Well, the very first thing that you get on the very first page is that in 1910, Ursula is born. She's born in 1910, and she dies in childbirth because the umbilical cord is wrapped around her neck, and neither Bridget, who's about 14 and pretty ditzy and doesn't really know what to do, nor the mother are terribly sure what they should be doing, or are unaware of what the impact is. The doctor isn't there. The midwife hasn't made it. Later on, you get an iteration where the doctor actually does make it through the snow. And then later on, you get another iteration where he doesn't. But the mother and Bridget find a pair of scissors and cut the cord and make sure that that's all okay. So it's all gets to the end.
And Sylvie, the mother is actually prepared for that too. That's interesting too.
Okay.
The fact that maybe Sylvie has some sense of what's going
forward.
Yeah,
I think that's
too,
probably stretching it a bit, but maybe. You know, I thought it was an interesting concept. I thought it was handled well. I thought the book went on a bit too much though, because it's over 500 pages. The TV series is 4 1-hour episodes, isn't it? Something like that. So about 250 minutes, somewhere around there. And so if you take one page of a screenplay per minute on the screen, you're talking about a 250-page screenplay, which probably comes in at about 350-400 pages. So I thought the TV series was actually better than the novel. I don't know, you're going to hate me for this, because I think it got rid of a fair bit of the stuff that was there that just seemed to be self-indulgent to me in with the author. Now, I can understand if you were going back through it, the book over and over, you would probably pick up a fair bit. And this is another thing that I have to bring up about this. I have a feeling that my thoughts about reading the book were impacted by the fact that I was reading this rather complicated structured book on an e-reader and not on paper. The thing about this particular novel is you really do want to be able to go back and go, hang on a minute, flip. Where are we again? Oh, yeah, okay. How does this fit in with the novel? And sort of work your way right through. And, yes, I can see you're holding up.
This is my copy of the book with all your
post-it notes in it.
Little bookmark things
all the way through. And so you need to be able to sort of follow the tracks going through by going back and having a bit of a look. Now, where are we again? Because it does jump around. It will jump. You will start an iteration back at the birth, or you might start it when she's just been saved from a drowning incident, which happens when she's about 4 or 5, something like that. With her sister Pamela. She drowns in one iteration and then basically is saved in another one. And sometimes she'll die, and the next thing that you know of the next iteration is basically in the 1930s, where she is sort of trying to decide whether she's going to go and study in Germany, where she does, and where she meets a future husband, has a child. He joins the Nazi party, joins the war, gets killed in the war, and she's in Berlin when it's absolutely bombed into obliteration. And then then she finds that the only thing left for her, because she's worried about the fact that the Russians are coming in from the east, and that she and her daughter are basically going to get raped and murdered, that she commits suicide and the murder suicide of the herself and the daughter. So there's all of that, and then it will jump back to somewhere in the middle. So it's not consistent about where it starts. Although you probably get 4-5 versions of the birth. The TV series does jump back early on in the first couple of the deaths back to the birth again, and you get different versions of that, and then carries on from there. But it will jump a number of years because there's no point going through all of that information again, because that would be really tediously boring. And I thought they handled it pretty well in the TV series.
I thought they handled it very well. I like that little thing of the snow coming down each time she dies. This snow, she sees snow.
Well,
starting
the blackness
to fall.
Starts to fall, darkness falls, and then the snow starts coming down. And that's
yeah. But in the TV series, it's that it's the little bit of snow that you realize that things
even
are going
even
on.
Though it might be a sunny day, suddenly she's sitting there and you think the snow starts to fall. You thought, oh, she's dying. So you get the idea. So
she's about to die,
I thought it was handled extremely well. I thought. I reckon it's probably about as good as TV adaptation as you could make of this, because
I reckon so. It's
a fairly complicated structure, and I would say that although people may have seen Groundhog Day, it's not the same in a lot of people's eyes who haven't read any more. Using this particular sort of in this particular subgenre, they're only going to have seen Groundhog Day, and that was just one day going around, and it was a comedy, and they may not necessarily have picked up on what it was that was going on. So the makers of this particular TV adaptation were having to think of this as being going out fresh into the world where most of the viewers were not familiar with the concept. And I thought they handled it very well in that regard, and made sure that you figured out what was going on pretty quickly. I go with the idea about, okay, so what does my wife know about this? She's not a big reader of science fiction. She has definitely seen Groundhog Day. I suggested that we watch this because, you know, you and I were going to be watching it. So, and she really greatly enjoyed it, thought it was absolutely wonderful.
So she
enjoyed it, didn't have any problem with the concepts whatsoever. So obviously the TV adaptation handled that very well and explained it all as best they possibly could. And I thought they did very well.
The other thing I thought they did very well was because you're going back and back and back again, they had to deal with Ursula as a child at different ages. And so there's a number of child actors in it. And I thought that the casting there was very good because, I mean, in a series, when you if you're watching a movie which is a biopic, you have a young character cast as the young central character, and then you move on, and you leave that behind, and you're into the adult character. You never really have to compare the two together. Whereas in this, you're constantly having to, in a way, to compare the adult Ursula with the younger Ursula. And I thought the casting was done very well, because that seemed to me to be seamless. I never had any doubts that it was the same character.
I felt the same.
I thought that was done very well.
You know, because you're going to be jumping back from a time when Ursula is in her late 20s, early 30s, all the way back to when she's 3 or 4 or 5. And yes, I agree. I didn't get any sense of dislocation when I was jumping back. This person looks nothing like them. Is nothing like them. So I'm just assuming that what they did was the script was all completed. And the filming must have been done. We're just going to do this scene and this scene and this scene and this scene and use the kids continuously for the whole lot, and then gradually work your way through and do all the rest. And so that takes a fair bit of shuffling in terms of your production and also your scripting and your editing later on. And it worked. It worked very, very well. I would hardly recommend that people see the TV adaptation. I was a bit disappointed in the novel because I didn't think it rounded things off the way that I would have liked it to have done. I think on the basis, David, as I said earlier, that I think that what it is that it sets up a premise that seems to have a solution which is going to have an ending. And to me, I didn't feel as though that, yes, I'll take your point that there's the solution that she finds that her major aim in all of these iterations is that she has to continually go and kill Hitler every time, knowing that it's going to kill her because the body, because there's nowhere to get close to him, even by the time that, by the time that she is old enough to be able to be in Germany on her own and be able to be wandering around, he has then got to the point where he has enough influence over people around him that he has a large number of bodyguards. So she can't go back and sort of kill him when he's just out of the First World War, for example, because he's only 8 or 10 and wouldn't be capable of it and wouldn't have been allowed to go there on her own anyway. So she knows that she is going to die every time she kills Hitler. But it's just like another loop going round and round.
Do you think she kills him more than once?
I think she does kill him more than once.
I don't know. That's interesting, isn't it? Does she kill him more than once? I don't know. Okay. Interesting. It's certainly, it's one of those books which leaves you thinking very deeply, I think. So that's one of the reasons I like it.
Well, I think...
But you're right. It is a literary book. It's not a genre book by any means. It's definitely a literary book.
It's a literary novel that utilises a science fictional meme, similar sort of things like The Time Traveller's Wife. That is a literary novel that uses the science fiction meme or idea of time travel. Mm. That's time travel's gone out of the science fiction genre now. It's part of the general culture, and I'm thinking that if there was another one of these fairly shortly, then this would have gone as well. So if they actually get the point where they make Replay, which make a film adaptation of it. I was reading that there was an attempt to make it, but it fell over. I think it probably deserves to be done. I mean, because of course the concept is interesting enough. And they haven't, filmmakers have not said, oh, well, somebody's made a time travel movie, we can't make one for five or 10 years.
No.
It's just a concept that they can wrap a story frame around. So, story around that particular framework. And why not use it?
Now you thought the novel was fairly long. Yes. You would maybe, or may not be interested in the fact that there is a sequel.
Oh, okay. Oh, dear.
Called A God in Ruins, which is about Teddy's life. It's all based around Teddy's life, but it's the Todd family again, Fox Corner where they live, and his experiences during the war. But this one doesn't have the concept of the multiple parallel lives. It's just a straight telling of Teddy's life, but it's well worth reading too. All of her books are well worth reading.
All right, so you aren't going to tell me what happens in this one. So, in terms of the end,
He survives the war. He dies as an old man.
Oh, okay. So this is the iteration where he survives the war.
Yeah, he dies as an old man.
Right,
in that
one. All right.
It's good, but anyway, it is good. But so I'm a big, big fan of all her books. I've read all of her novels. The only thing I haven't read of hers is there's a collection of short stories which I must get hold of and read because I read all the stuff that she writes.
All right, yes. Well, my wife's recently this year become a fan of the Jackson Brodie crime series which you have mentioned previously.
Yeah.
They're
not straight crime either. You know, they're sort of on the edge of literary fiction, I guess.
All right. All right,
good. Well, I think we've beaten that much.
I think so. We could look at it. Certainly is an interesting idea. It's an interesting concept. And it's also interesting to see how people from outside our sort of field, if you like, are able to take some of these interesting concepts and be able to put their own slight little twist on it. Because there's enough twists and changes in what Atkinson does here to be able to make this certainly worthwhile and up there with the best uses of the concept that I've read so far. just because I don't like the way that it ended is just my problem, nobody else's, and that's fine. All right. Okay, well, that's an interesting set of connections there between our casual reading and the one that we set out to read for this particular episode, David. So it worked out really well. We're just about done then.
In fact, we are done.
We are done. I think we can draw a line under this particular episode and think about what we're going to do the next one. So we shall do just that, and we shall be back in a couple of weeks.
3 weeks.
Three, probably. We'll talk to you then. Thanks, David.
Bye.